Sharing time with someone we care about can do more than boost our moods, according to our guest this hour. Face-to-face interaction also bolsters our health and could lengthen our lives. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are going to talk about the benefits of face-to-face contact with our guest psychologist, the author of The Village Effect. And we will welcome your questions for her. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Do you think you get enough face-to-face contact in your life, in your work life, in your home life? We will welcome your questions and your experiences. And we'll talk about how we can get more face-to-face contact in our lives. Our guest is Susan Pinker. She is a developmental psychologist, newspaper columnist, and broadcaster. She is the author of The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
What exactly do you mean by the village effect?
Well, the village effect is a metaphor for the social contact we all need to survive and thrive, because not all forms of social contact are created equal.
Yeah, and I get a lot of social contact on Facebook. Is that good enough?
No, you know, paradoxically, it's not. What we're finding from the research is that the more people interact online, especially with social media, the less they tend to be involved in their own communities, their bricks and mortar communities. So there tends to be a trade-off with the time we invest in screen activities and the time we invest in face-to-face relationships.
Yeah, so you say Americans are lonelier than ever. How do you measure this?
Well, you know, we're more connected now than we ever were before because of our devices, but we've never been lonelier. And one way that's being measured is by the General Social Survey, which is kind of like a census where they call up, you know, every so many Americans in, you know, make sure that it's properly sampled across the country. And they've discovered through this survey that in the 1980s, we had more or less three people that we could depend on, that we could confide in, that we could lean on at difficult times. Now that number is less than two, and many people just have one person or none at all. And so this is really, I think, a huge social problem. There's more than 62 million people in the U.S. who say they are deeply lonely and they're unhappy about it.
Yeah. Well, so if I have one or two close friends, why is that a problem?
I'll tell you why, Joy, because the social survey is not just measuring your friendships, but that one or two means your spouse, your parents, your children, your close friends, your neighbors, your colleagues. Among all those people, people have maybe one or two. So, of course, one or two close friends is probably enough for many people. But there's something else that's really interesting, which is that we're losing the middle layer of friendships and relationships that we used to have just by moving through our day. So we used to talk to our neighbors, for example, much more than we do now. Now we're more likely to get into our cars in the garage and just drive off to work and at the end of the day repeat that exercise. Mm-hmm. People at work, for example, don't necessarily, some people work at home and from remote offices. Others at work, I mean, they'll shoot an email to somebody in an office three or four doors down instead of getting up to talk to them. Schools, for example, are much more focused on the relationship between a child or a university student and his or her screen rather than with other students in the class or with the teacher. And many of the natural places where we just used to gather, you know, the square in your town or the grocery store, the library, the bookstore, the post office, all of these places are starting to disappear.
Yeah, and so this is, we're not just talking about our close circle of friends and family. We're talking a lot about that middle layer, that we don't have enough face-to-face contact with that middle layer.
Exactly. So that, not just the close contacts, but that middle layer and even a more remote layer is what I'm referring to as the village effect. And that little phrase comes from the fact that I went to investigate a place where people live a very long time. There are more centenarians there than almost anywhere else in the world. And remarkably, it's the only place where men live as long as women. Because I learned when I was researching my last book that there's a 5 to 7 year lifespan gap between men and women on average. And part of the reason for that lifespan gap we're starting to learn is that women tend to groom their relationships much more seriously over their lifetimes, tend to have many more social contacts, go out, see people more. You know, if you think about yourself or your female friends, you're more likely to come home from your workday, pick up the phone, and find out how people are. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge factor in not only how happy you are, but also how long you tend to live. So I went to this particular village to find out how does that social contact play out in their lives.
Yeah, and how did it play out in their lives?
Yeah, well, you know, when I arrived, I had a few surprises, frankly, because I arrived with my high-tech tape recorder because I wanted to make a radio documentary, mm-hmm. and my daughter, my university-age daughter, was with me, too, to help out. And what I discovered, first to my great frustration, is that these centenarians are never alone, so they're never really left to answer their own questions or to finish a sentence. And from somebody who's involved in radio, you know what that feels
yeah.
like.
Right.
Right. So at first, you know, the first interview when I arrived in the centenarian was surrounded by 6 people. And, of course, I had my own little team of my daughter and my interpreter. There were like 8, 9 people in the room. I thought, this is ridiculous. And then, as it happened again and again, I realized these older folks are never left alone. They always have somebody to talk to. They always have, quote, their village right at their fingertips. They're not kind of shoved off to the periphery of society the way we're more likely to do with our elders here. They're, first of all, most of them live in their own homes or in the homes of relatives, and people consider them an incredible value and treasure to the community and spend a lot of time with them. I mean, one researcher said, you know, oh, well, they spend their time surrounded by people with whom they like to natter.
Yeah.
So I think this is part of what I mean by the village effect, is that it's not just that social contact has a biological impact on how your cells function, which also determines how long you live, but it also determines whether you want to live a long time. Because let's face it, Joy, if you're isolated, if all your friends and your spouse or your partner has died, if you don't get to go out much and you're alone, you might not want those extra years.
Right, I was going to say. But I also wanted to ask you, how can we be so sure that it's this face-to-face social contact that is helping people live longer?
Yeah, that's a great question. In the case of that particular area, the reason I went there is because there's very thorough science that's been done. So we know, for example, that the genetic component accounts for about 25% of longevity, because they are able to measure, you know, they've done gene studies of the people in that area compared to surrounding villages outside that particular, what they call a blue zone. So there's 75% of the longevity that's not accounted for by genes, but there's other factors like exercise and diet to be sure. So that's a good question, but the even more important question is it that social people live longer, right? Because mm-hmm. it's not just that village, but many, many different population studies that tell us that. Or is it the type of person who is likely to go out and seek social contact is also the more likely to be a healthy person? Like, what comes first? So what's important in that particular question is, you know, there's 2 things. One is that not just one study, but many, many population studies tell us that when we measure everything about a whole community, how much they smoke, how much they drink, whether their marriages are satisfying, what their weight is like, whether the air is clean, whether they treat their hypertension, et cetera, the most predictive feature of their lives is the degree and quality of their social contact. So if we looked at everybody, for example, in a small community now of, say, 40,000, and came back in 7 years, we'd be best able to predict who would still be alive by how much social contact they had. So getting back to our chicken and egg question, what's really important there is that, okay, even if people who tend to be healthier and more outgoing are more likely to seek social contact, it still means that it's predictive somehow. So those of us who want to live longer can adopt those habits in the hope that they will extend our lives. Just the way we exercise, you know, we may not be Olympic athletes, but many of us exercise because it promotes well-being and health. Or just as, you know, many of us are not, you know, on hugely, you know, vegan or whatever kinds of diets, but we try to eat healthy foods and avoid certain types of fats, et cetera, because we know that's correlated with a long, healthy life. And I think that social contact and integrated social contact is exactly the same.
Yeah. Well, here's an idea. Do what I do. No, what I do is I do like to exercise, and I do like to be social in that exercise. And I have classes, group exercise classes that I go to, and many of the people who are in those classes have become friends, and they are. It makes it. I think that's a part of that middle layer, isn't it?
Absolutely. So your intuition was bang on, and in the book, which is really a book about human stories that illustrate the science, this new field called social neuroscience, many of the stories kind of revolve around people that I met through my swim team. Mm-hmm. And I did exactly what you did, which is I thought, well, I want to exercise, but I want to do it in a way that allows me to meet people. So instead of swimming laps alone in the pool, I joined a swim team. And many of those swim team members actually are profiled in the book because they have managed to deploy their social networks to get through huge challenges in their life, say, for example, breast cancer. So I think the idea of doing, say, exercise with a group, you get more bang for your buck, not only through your exercise because you're more likely to work harder when you're with a group or a team, but you also get that really beneficial social contact. And there's other ways that you can build your own village as well that aren't that hard.
Well, we'll talk about some of those ways we can build our own village, and we will welcome questions from our listeners, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. What do you do to try to increase your face-to-face contact? Not just with your close friends and family, but with others in the community. And do you buy this? Do you think that more face-to-face contact can make us healthier, happier, and smarter? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Susan Pinker. She's the author of The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. And we welcome your questions for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Susan, we're talking some about how we can create our own village. So talk some more about that. What do you recommend to people to create our own village?
Well, there are a lot of small things that you can do that can have a huge impact. So when I was researching the book and the evidence was starting to build about how important this was, I started to change my own habits in small ways. So, for example, I looked at my day, and if I hadn't had social contact in the day, instead of spending the evening reading, for example, or doing more revisions on what I'd written that day, I made sure I got out and saw people, just the way you would make sure that you had regular meals in your day, because social contact is a biological need, just like food and drink and exercise and sleep, for example. So I also did small things like if I saw that, you know, my neighbor was out walking her dog, I'd make sure that I stopped to talk to her and had a few minutes just to check in and see how she was. You know, I also did things that were a little bit more costly, not only in terms of my pocketbook, but time, which is that if I had a friend who was important to me and I hadn't seen her in a year or so because she'd moved away or I'd moved away, either one, I would make sure to make a plan to get on a plane or get on a train and see her. Because one of the things I learned, Joy, in researching this book is that our relationships decay. So without face-to-face contact, you don't have that long before your spot in somebody's social circle is replaced with somebody else. So it's kind of like a perennial garden. You know, after the winter, there are little holes that develop because certain plants haven't made it through the winter. And your relationships are exactly like that. Between about 18 months and 4 or 5 years, if you haven't seen a friend in person and groomed that relationship or, you know, sort of focused on that relationship, then really that person is really gone in your network and you're gone in hers or his. So I changed my habits in that I made sure I put aside some time and money to see the people who were important to me. There are other things that people can do too, like, for example, at critical moments in their lives, when you're looking to live in a new place, look for a community where people cross paths and talk to each other. Don't focus on how big your driveway is, for example. Does the place have sidewalks? Does it have stores you can walk to? Because communities that are built around cars are less likely to focus on social interaction. That's something that is pretty well established. Looking for a school for your child, whether it's a preschool or an elementary school or a high school, is this something that is spending a lot of time and money touting their technological prowess? Because what we know from the research is it's not the devices that help kids learn, it's the teachers. So really there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that laptop programs, iPad programs, whiteboard programs have any impact on learning. And in some cases, they make kids' grades drop.
Yeah, and I see a suggestion here, which is something I think we're going to do after the show today, is that my producers and I are going to go out and get coffee. So have a group coffee break at work.
Yes, and that's a great idea because, you know, as you probably noticed in the book, one of the studies I quote of about 25,000 call center agents showed that those call center agents who had coordinated coffee breaks had increased productivity. So the ones who had staggered breaks, meaning they went on break at different times, which is actually the standard in the industry, didn't have that boost in productivity. So something simple that costs absolutely nothing, I mean, it might cost, you know, the price of a cup of coffee, actually can boost people's productivity about 20%.
And we're assuming this is because it makes us happier and we like our coworkers and then we like our job more and then we work more.
Well, there's a couple of reasons. I think at the macro level, it's exactly as you say, that it gives us a little mood booster. And also, for concrete reasons, if you're having a little problem that you can't solve on your own and you just happen to mention it to a coworker at a break, you know, boy, I had this client who was really difficult and I just couldn't satisfy him or her, and that person might say, you know how I deal with that? This is the tack I use. So you can share little tidbits of information that could help you do your job better. But also on the micro level, when you connect with somebody, you know, even something as simple as like a high five or a fist bump or a little pat on the arm, oxytocin is released. And this damps down stress, and it also increases your mood, and it also helps learning and productivity. So at the large level, you feel better, you get kind of little helpful hints about how to do your job better, but actually there are kind of biological events that are going on behind the scene that we're not all that aware of, but that help us feel better and actually protect our health and our resilience long into the future.
Our guest is Susan Pinker, a developmental psychologist. She is the author of The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. And we wonder if you have any examples of this, or if you have any questions for her, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. To the phones we go. Jack in Freeport, Illinois is with us. Hello, Jack.
Yes, good morning. My most satisfying way of contacting is table tennis or ping pong. It's excellent exercise. It can be a social gathering. You know, you can have conversation. You can have in-between games and that type of thing. But you're close. And you get to make good friends doing something that's really enjoyable.
It sounds like a blast, Jack. Susan Pinker, reaction? But ping pong, playing ping pong. But also, maybe this will be an opportunity for us to get into the differences between men and women and their social contacts.
Well, you know, I had two thoughts about that. The first is I think that's a wonderful idea because you're active, you're meeting new people. And the other little piece of that puzzle is it's probably structured into your week. Like you have a ping pong game and it happens at specific times. So you get out there and you meet those people at specific times. And this is the kind of social contact we need to focus on more and more because it's disappearing from our lives. So just the way, for example, you often have three meals a day, and that structures not only when you eat, but your social contact. Now, because it's not built into the day the way it used to be, where we used to meet people when we lived in smaller communities, we need that ping pong game. Mm-hmm. We need that swim team practice or whatever your exercise class is, per se, to structure it so that you know, okay, it's, say, for example, 7 p.m. on a Tuesday, I'm going out to meet my buddies to play table tennis. And it's not negotiable. So I think that's a wonderful thing. To respond to the male-female aspect, I was thinking immediately about that because often women don't need that kind of structure to have social time. In other words, they can just pick up the phone or get together over a coffee and they can have a rewarding conversation. But for men, it's harder to do that. It feels like wasting time. So I think for men, if they want to increase their social contact, it's a really great idea to focus it around an activity.
Sounds good, Jack. Have fun playing ping pong. Connie in Portage is with us now. Hi, Connie.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. I was wondering if she had found any difference or, like, the difference between which makes the elderly happy, being closer to the family or to friends. And then I have to tell you what I like to do she answers that.
All right. Is there an answer to that, Susan?
Well, I don't have a specific answer to that, but what I can say is that there were little surprises for me along the way when I was researching this book. And one of the surprises was a piece of research that shows that elderly people live longer and are happier when they live amongst other people like themselves. So this really threw me for a loop because I was under the impression that we should have kind of mixed communities, but essentially older people, many of whom might be widowed or alone, feel more comfortable and get more social support if they live amongst other people who are experiencing the same thing. So when you think about it, it's not all that counterintuitive. So what I mean is not necessarily that they should live in retirement communities or villages, but that it's better for them to be around, as your caller says, friends in a community where people like them are likely to settle down. So in the book, I say, you know, it's better for them to be in a place like Boca Raton in Florida than to be in Brooklyn where everybody's, you know, riding fixed-gear bikes or, you know, doing things that are more common among, you know, 20- and 30-year-olds. And about the family aspect, when I was talking about relationships decaying, your family relationships are a bit protected from that. So you are more likely to be able to hang on to those relationships longer without having to see people. But that said, we do know that there's studies, for example, of women in Japan that show that women who haven't had contact with their families, regular contact with their families, are more likely to die young. So essentially, my answer to that question is you need both.
Yeah. But you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Connie, but you have a preference, don't you?
Well, I shouldn't say that, but I play euchre about 3 or 4 times a week, and I'm a retired nurse, and I just have to be around people. And we laugh and carry on, and I just won't miss playing euchre. And we take road trips together, some of the women. It's just a wonderful thing to do.
Oh, wonderful. And, well, that makes sense, Susan. You can still have, you know, close relationship with your family members, but you want to go beyond that as well, right?
Well, absolutely, because, you know, as everybody knows, your family members have their own lives to pursue. And what's really important is not having a social life that is unidimensional. So your callers, and I must say, Wisconsin sounds like a fabulous place.
Ping pong and euchre and what else?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, what's really important, and your callers are hitting on that, is that you have to have varied types of social contact. So, yeah, of course you should see your family, but you also need the relationship with your friends, whether it's the people you play euchre or table tennis with. And you also need relationships with the people in your community, whether it's your church or your synagogue, or whether it's a community group that you volunteer with, or just the person that you see three times a week because that's where you buy your fruits and vegetables, for example. So to build that in to your day-to-day life is something that we have to really try to do intentionally. And in the book, you know, I tell a lot of stories about how people are trying to do that now more than ever before because they're forced to.
How so?
Well, because, for example, many of us work from remote offices, so we no longer have colleagues. Or if we do have colleagues, they're spread among different cities, and the companies we work for now is cutting back on travel so that we don't get to see them. Also, because of, I guess, what I call the digital dilemma, a lot of our lives have migrated online because it's cheaper and it's convenient in many cases. And so this is kind of sucking away many of the face-to-face interactions that we just had as part of our day.
Yeah. Does it, I don't know, there's FaceTime, there's, you know, the technology, we can actually see each other doing these meetings from around the country, but that's not the same thing?
Not at all. And it's an irony, really, because the closer we get to actually, you know, seeing and feeling and touching each other, the better it is, of course. So the more cues you get about the other person, the better the contact. So, for example, you know, telephone is better than email, and email is better than text. But when we look at studies that compare the impact of, say, either face-to-face contact or voice contact with digital connection, we find that the impact is not at all the same. So do I have time to tell you just a couple of stories? So, for example, there was one study where they actually stressed out adolescent girls on purpose. They gave them timed math problems to solve in front of an audience. And that would stress anybody out, but especially teenagers who are so concerned about their reputations. And they divided those girls into four groups. One group got a visit from mom after the test. Mm-hmm. One group got a call from mom after the test. One group got a text from mom after the test, and one group got nothing. And what they found is when they measured cortisol, which is a chemical that is secreted when we're under stress, so they had these girls spit in a cup, and they measured their cortisol levels, and they found that the levels of cortisol that were secreted during this stressful situation came down when there was a visit from mom, came down just a teeny bit less when there was a call from mom. But when there was a text from mom, there was no change in their cortisol levels. And their cortisol levels, when there was a text from mom and when there was nothing, were identical.
Really?
So many of us think that it's equivalent because we make the mistake in thinking that communication is all about the content of the message. So, you know, if you text your child and say, "I'm with you all the way, honey," you think that it's the same thing as looking your child in the eye and giving her a hug and saying that. But the evidence tells us that that's not at all the case. So obviously I'm not knocking digital devices. I mean, I'm not about to throw away my laptop or cell phone. They're great for sharing information, but they're just not great for human connection.
Take another call. Dana in Janesville. Hello, Dana.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
We recently moved to Janesville from a small bedroom community. And the change has been just extremely profound from the aspect that when we were in the small bedroom community, we were fairly involved only because our children were going to school there and involved in sports and that. But we found once the kids left home and we were in this small community, we really didn't have a lot of roots there and there wasn't a lot going on. So when we came back to Janesville, we know almost and we've only been here maybe 8 months, we know almost everybody around our block. I mean, everybody is out. They say hello. There's dog walkers. I mean, even people you don't know walking dogs say hello to you. Or, you know, what kind of dog is yours? Or everybody pets each other's dog. We actually have neighbors who actually, people don't sit in their backyards here. They're out in their driveways or the patios where they can see people coming by. And so people kind of know everything that is superficially going on in people's lives. And it's not to be nosy, but it's just a genuine interest level. And it is just such a complete difference. You feel like you've got roots, like, you know, you belong to a community. You've got an emotional investment in it. And it has been just really, really transforming. I mean, it's a culture that we have not been accustomed to for the last 10 years. So it's been a very, very positive. And it's actually gotten to the point where my husband is like, he comes home from working. I mean, there's people talking to us, the phone rings, things like that. And we're just not used to that.
Yeah, but Dana, I wanted to jump in to ask, why is it so different in the Janesville neighborhood where you are now from the neighborhood you came from?
Their park system, their recreation system here. I mean, not only do we have family here, but I think it's because in the community we lived in, everybody commuted into the bigger city to work. And then they came home and they were just home. Where here, most everybody that lives in this town works in this town. So you don't have the commuting thing going on.
I get it. And it sounds like it's a wonderful social neighborhood. And that's important, Susan.
It is important. I'm interested in finding out from this caller whether she went out expressly to look for that when she was moving.
Dana, did you specifically look for the neighborhood in Janesville, that type of atmosphere?
What we were looking for in Janesville was an older neighborhood, and because we are empty nesters, we were looking for a smaller home. So we got lucky. Now, whether this is indicative of all of Janesville or not, I don't know, but I can tell you we know everybody's names on this block, and whether that's indicative of all the neighborhoods here, I can't tell you that, but because we've got sidewalks and we've got a dog, we're out walking, so we get a lot of exposure to people.
Yeah. Susan?
Well, you know, it's a great story, and I will comment on that in that I think you got lucky. But people can go out and expressly look for that because it's so important. And, you know, it's quite, I guess, heartwarming account of how important it is that your physical environment be set up for social interaction, because right now very few people are thinking about it. For example, when we look at our kids' lives, you know, right now the statistics are that our school-age children are spending over 7 hours a day in front of a screen. So I don't know if it's because our communities are not built for them to have safe places to play, or because adults are so busy commuting to and from work that there's nobody to supervise them to play outside and with their peers, or because people just think it's good for them, which it is not. But there are many, I guess, features of our lives, including the lives of our young people, which don't really center around that type of casual social contact that Dina was talking about.
We're talking with Susan Pinker. She is a developmental psychologist, newspaper columnist, and broadcaster. She is the author of The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. And we are talking about the benefits of face-to-face interaction and talking about how we can get more face-to-face interaction in our communities and how we can create our own village effect. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We'd love to hear more of your examples on how you try to get more face-to-face contact in your lives. But we'll also talk about what do we do if we're introverts? Are we doomed? Do we have to seek out that face-to-face contact in order to be healthy and happy and smart? That's coming up on the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about how we can increase our FaceTime, the real FaceTime, face-to-face contact, relationships, not only with close friends and family, but with others in the neighborhood, at work, at school, talking about how face-to-face contact can make us healthier, happier, and smarter. Susan Pinker is our guest. She is the author of The Village Effect. And we have other callers that I'd like to get to. But what about, Susan Pinker, those who, you know, consider themselves introverts? I mean, do they have to go out of their way to make, you know, friends, have more face-to-face contact in order to live a long, happy life?
Yes, they do. So I think one of the myths is that introverts don't need social contact and they shouldn't have it forced on them. And though I agree with the latter, I think that what is not true, not correct, is that they don't need social contact. They just need less of it, and they need to control how and when they get it. So it would be like saying, you know, oh, this person has a small appetite, they don't need to eat. Oh, yes, they do. They just need to have a smaller portion, or they need to decide what they want when they want it. So what the research tells us about introverts is that they need social contact as much as anybody else. And if they don't get it, they get sick. So for introverts who find it more difficult to connect, they may have to work a little bit harder to incorporate it into their lives as opposed to somebody who is an extrovert. And that's where an interesting feature of the internet comes in that it has kind of a differential effect depending on your personality. And so researchers call that the rich get richer, the poor get poorer phenomenon. So people who are naturally extroverted, well, they just use their email and Facebook and all their social networks to make plans to see each other.
Yeah.
You know, they use Foursquare, you know, let's meet up here, et cetera, et cetera. So they're already seeing each other, and then they use the internet to do more of that. But what happens with many introverts is that it becomes a replacement for real social contact because, frankly, it's the path of least resistance. So if you find social interaction difficult, well, of course, it's a lot easier to do it through email. You don't have to deal with the other person's reactions to you or their facial expressions. You can do it on your own time. You don't have to be interrupted. And so many introverts mistakenly kind of create a wall around themselves using, I would say, the digital world, and interact only through that medium. And what we know about that is that it does nothing to reduce loneliness. So it's a mistake, I think, for introverts to think that, A, they don't need social contact face-to-face, or, B, that this is a good replacement.
Let's go back to the phones. Linda in the Green Bay area right now. Hi, Linda.
Hello, Joy and Susan. It's good to talk with you. I want to talk about family and how sometimes Wisconsin Public Radio people become our family. I recently had surgery, and Joy, I had some hallucination with the pain medication afterwards, and you were talking to me day and night, Joy. You were in the wall behind my bed.
I'm sorry. Did I bother you, Linda?
No, it was wonderful. It was comforting.
So that's really hilarious. What was I saying? Just radio show stuff?
Yeah, it was your radio show stuff and your smiley voice and friendly. And you know. But then about 2 o'clock in the morning, I asked my friend if she'd please turn the radio off.
And then the friend said, there is no radio on.
Right, yeah. Right.
Oh,
but you're full-time. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, but that I'm glad you brought this up. That's a funny story. But what about we do consider our listeners our friends, and our listeners consider us friends on the radio, Susan? Not the same as the face to face, though.
No, and it's not the same. But it's not to say that there's anything harmful about radio. Not at all. And radio can be a sort of a companion throughout the day. But it would be like saying, for example, well, you know, I have bread in the morning, so I don't actually need to have any protein or vegetables.
All right.
I mean, you know, I mean, I love my toast and coffee too, but it's not enough to sustain you. So, I mean, Joy, your program, I'm sure, is great, and your listeners have a great relationship with you. But I think this is an interesting, I guess, example of the way we think that one type of contact will suffice for the whole gamut that we need as human beings. We've evolved over 60 million years to read each other's thoughts and emotions in close proximity to each other. And so the farther and farther we get away from that, the more we kind of miss that physiologically. We miss the signal, so it's harder to empathize with people who are not right in front of us, which is, by the way, why we get such things as internet trolls, okay, because they don't have to deal with anybody's reaction. Uh-huh. They don't have to empathize with anybody. They're at some remove, okay? So there's that aspect, but there's also the biological aspect. You know, what was really striking while researching this book is some of the data are astounding. So, for example, you know, you can't take people and isolate them and compare them to people who are not isolated because that's not ethical, but you can do it to rats. And when you do it to rats, what you find out is that rats, female rats that are raised in isolation, develop 84 times the number of cancer tumors, specifically breast cancer tumors, as female rats that are raised in groups. So there is something that is biologically beneficial about the social contact that I think few of us are really aware of at the moment.
Yeah. Well, Linda, thank you so much for calling in. I thought that was a wonderful story. I think, though, Linda was also had a friend there sitting with her as she was recuperating
it's
from her
true.
Surgery. So,
yeah.
So she had more than just the hallucination of my voice.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, thank you so much. Katie in Clinton is with us. Hi, Katie.
Hi, good morning. Enjoying the show. I just had a comment. You were talking before about some of the, like, retirees or as you get older and they no longer have the workplace. There's a lot of the school districts or libraries or just about any place that will accept volunteers or very short hours. I know in Clinton we have, in our lunch program, we have two-hour people. And all they do is come in and either help serve the food or in the case of a very dear friend of mine, she helps me with running the checkouts. And it definitely keeps her young. She looks forward to that time, you know, we come in and gather as a group. And then we serve the kids. And it's fun to watch these kids come through and watch them grow up and yet still interact with somebody similar to your own age.
So volunteering is a great way to get some face-to-face time, Susan?
Yeah, and it's just another example. You know, we talked about table tennis. We talked about euchre. We talked about walking your dog and meeting your neighbors and volunteering at a school or a library. They're just all different examples of how you structure meeting people on a regular basis, and people who are not necessarily exactly like you. And doing something simple like that can add as many years to your life as, say, taking beta blockers or quitting a pack-a-day cigarette habit. So it not only makes you feel good, you're adding to your community, and you're increasing your well-being and health.
Thank you, Katie. Monica emails, seeing and talking to people in exercise, class, and casual interaction are not the same as building intimate relationships, which is what most of us seek. How's that? What about that? Maybe we really do lack in that intimate relationship, and that's probably worse, I think Monica is saying.
I think we need both, and Monica is absolutely right that they're not equivalent. I'd say the only relationship that I could say be is that we need both of them to survive and thrive, and that sometimes those casual relationships can deepen and become those deeper, intimate relationships. And so if we don't have that mechanism, there's no way for us to add on to those that close circle so we can build from having one person to two people to three people. And what we know is that at really difficult times in our lives, say during you know, an environmental crisis like an ice storm or a hurricane or a heat wave, the people who are most likely to make it are the ones who have people who cared enough to check up on them. And where do they come from? It's not only, say, your husband or wife or your child who does this, but it's also that next layer, your neighbor, for example, or your coworker who says, gee, she lives in a flood zone. I better, like, go and see what happened to her. So we do need that intimate, close relationship, but actually those are not enough for us.
Yeah, we need those casual ones or those middle ones, too.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, maybe I used the wrong word when I used casual. I think you meet them casually, but those relationships can become really quite integral to your lives. So the people that you might, say, play table tennis with or euchre with, you know, after about 10 or 15 years of that, you're pretty good friends.
Right. I mean, your neighbor could be a very good friend that you talk to who's walking her dog.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yasser in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Yasser.
Hello, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I have my two youngest daughters. One is a senior, one a junior in high school. They do play sports in high school, but they are always overwhelmed with homework and study. And they come home, they lock themselves in their room, they are honor students. But my daughter, who's a senior, she doesn't want to go out in the weekend. She has so much to do. There is a homework this, there is a study that. And should I be concerned about their mental...
Oh, yes, sir. Thank you for asking that question. We have just a minute to go, though, Susan. A kid's doing just too much homework in their room and not having any social interaction, hardly.
Yeah, I would say, number one, the American Pediatric Association has said no TVs in kids' rooms, number one. So that reduces some of the isolation of kids locking themselves up in there. And second, if they're locking themselves in their room and just doing homework, maybe they need to have that structured social time that some of your callers mentioned. So either a team sport or some sort of social activity like a youth group where they get out of their rooms and socialize, because there's nothing more important to a teenager's mental health than their social group.
Yeah. Well, what's the takeaway for our listeners?
Takeaway is that face-to-face social contact is a unique type of human need, and it can't be replaced by anything else. And so if we don't have enough of it in our lives, we have to structure it in any way we can, either through our neighborhoods, our schools, our sports or leisure activities, and we have to invest serious time in our friendships. And I think that's my lasting message.
And it's a good one. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Susan Pinker, developmental psychologist, newspaper columnist, broadcaster. She is the author of The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. Thanks very much to Christy Taylor and to Brianne Chasso for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I also hope that you join us tomorrow at this time. We will talk about how we learn. Our guest tomorrow will say sometimes it starts with forgetting or even falling asleep. We'll talk about these ideas and more when we talk to the author of How We Learn tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.